Chapter 4. Solace moves more surely now. Rotwe coaxes more life from its addled innards, and great chambers fill with fire. Work gangs drag heavy pallets of promethium canisters to the gate mouths, where spine-clamped plague ogrins shovel them into the shimmering moors. Conduits stiffen and flex, and pipelines bubble. The last of the iron shades are culled. The Death Guard are thorough. Kill teams prowl through the furthest reaches of the ship, hunting for any faint signs of life. The armor is taken from the corpses and sent to the bioforges. The weapons are carried off and given to the unbroken attendants to assess and divide up. The progenoids are ripped out by Clado, who never talks about what he does with them. He takes the eyes, too, and some of the other organs, but does not even pretend that this is for something useful. He has his hobbies. The rest, the thick-set flesh and bone, product of centuries of severe and serious-minded honing, is burned. The unbroken do not wish to have reminders of what they once were hanging around. The unchanged would like to eat the corpses, but they are not allowed to. There are some standards left. Some things are still not done. The numbers are collated. 42 tactical marines were landed. All were killed. 7 unbroken were similarly ended, in addition to several hundred unchanged. Those numbers are unexceptional. The Iron Shades were under-resourced and fighting on hostile territory. They would no doubt have planned to land more in short order, forming bridgeheads and bringing over heavy weaponry, but that never happened. The feeling on the ship is that everyone was fortunate, or blessed, perhaps. They send the numbers to Philemon. He enters them on his ledger. He pores over the thick man-flesh leaves and scrapes them with his long quill. He compares the outcome to previous engagements with similar enemies. He compiles a cross-reference table and scribbles out notes and marginalia. The little lords watch, some bored, some transfixed. Several of them plop down from the shelf to take a closer look. One of them defecates from excitement, causing snickering from the others. Philemon is irritated, puts it in a glass jar, and screws the lid on. The jar rattles around after that, with the tiny demon ranting inside, and is ignored. There are many jars in Philemon's chamber. Some are greater than human size, all of which are filled with cloudy liquor. There are shapes floating in those jars that are hard to make out. Others are smaller, containing tinctures and salves, ointments and witch brew. In one jar, bound with iron bars and capped with a silver lid, dwells the demon Count Quick. Count Quick looks like a scraggy crow, a black-feathered avian from Terran prehistory. The world he was taken from has no crows, never has done and never will, but demons are apt to take on archetypes from the broad sweep of human experience, and crows are a favourite. Over the centuries, the once glossy feathers have dulled, and there are bald patches on Count Quick's skinny hide. Its eyes, which flash yellow when angry, are filmy. This is strange because demons do not normally age or decay, but who knows what magics are at work with Count Quick. Philemon clipped its wings, put it in the jar, and whispered words of binding on the seal. Sometimes he lets the demon out, but only after saying certain rites and making sure that wards and shackling runes are traced out in disease-free mortal blood, which is a time-consuming task, and so rarely done. Count Quick has killed 10,345 mortals and consumed their souls. If you let it, it will tell you all about them. Most of the time, though, it mutters aimlessly. The little lords squat on its jar and stick their tongues out at it, and it squawks back and hisses at them. Count Quick is not its real name. Its real name is so maddeningly complex that to say it out loud would burst your eyeballs. Philemon calls it that because the demon understands the occult of the warp, the resonance and the repetition of the sacred numbers. You have to trick it into helping you, but now it is so ravenous and desperate that such tricks are often possible. Philemon comes up to it, peers into the jar, and shows it the ledgers.
"You approve, demon," he says.
Count Quick squints at the numbers.
"I remember when Your Lord Mortarion was born, it says.
There are two strange things about the way Count Quick speaks. One is the pause inserted into every sentence, as if its mind, or what passes for a mind, has some tick or impediment that cannot be eradicated. It is a regular affliction and does not seem to be getting worse. Philemon has never understood this. A demon is not a physical thing in the truest sense. It cannot be infected or degraded by the plagues of the world. Its visual and auditory aspect is chosen or dictated by sorcery. But then again, Philemon has never investigated too thoroughly. Demons are ineffably perplexing. That is why he keeps them in jars. The second strange thing is the way Count Quick's beak moves. A real avian does not speak. Its long beak is designed to peck the eyes from hanged corpses, not to form syllables. But Count Quick speaks. In order to form the sounds, its beak is flexible, and its tongue rolls and licks and flickers like a human's. Even after many centuries, Philemon still finds this unsettling to watch. There is a great blasphemy in the display, one that he cannot quite shake from his mind, despite the many other blasphemies he has either committed or witnessed. A crow should not speak like a man. It should not speak at all.
Yes, you have told me this often, Philemon says.
I saw all of them born in the warp, like stars being kindled.
I don't really care to hear this again.
One by one.
Philemon shows the demon the results of his calculations. There is trigonometry on the man flesh sheets, traced out in blotchy ink patterns, all annotated with more ledgers.
Do you approve of this? Any mistakes?
Count Quick glances at the working. Its gimlet eyes dart.
You place so much faith in these things.
They tell me where we are now, says Philemon, amid the halls of darkness, far from the witchlight of the corpse. They tell me we cannot follow the Death Lord, not right now. We are becalmed, lost in a pit of our own making.
So poetic.
That is what the calculations tell me. Vaux wants to know what to do next.
He could try making his own decisions.
Philemon laughs.
These are but guides.
The crow hops weakly from one claw to the other.
Even before we sent you the destroyer, Hive, you cleaved to this occult. You counted and you computed. That was never part of what was intended for you. Now it has become manic. Stop it.
Philemon puts the parchment away.
Too late. You changed us all right, but you never get exactly what you want.
We always get what we want.
Demonstrably false. You're in a jar.
For now.
Philemon smiles.
We have an abundance of freedom. The spaces between worlds are emptier than ever before. I see symmetries in the equations I've never seen before. Abaddon has unpicked something profound, hasn't he? You know what he's done, don't you?
Count Quick turns its head away. Philemon laughs.
So be it. I'll discover it in time.
He limps over to the table where the little lords roll and caper. He finds the one brought to him by Vaux and picks it up.
I could let you out more often, you know, he says to Count Quick, if you were a little more helpful.
The demon ignores him.
Fair enough,
says Philemon equably, setting off for the bridge with the little lord and the parchment.
I wouldn't trust me either.
Solus is powering on now. Gantries are hoisted back into position. Armor plating swells back into place. The lasburns pop and blister away. Thick coolant coagulates over ingress wounds, hardens, scabs over. auger arrays swivel back into functionality, and the ship's core burns with a sullen red heat again. The population scurries about in the darkness, squabbling over fetid scraps, sickening and weakening, but never quite dying. Vorks watches the viewports carefully. Drez Ul is struggling, trying to make sense of semi-functional readings that scatter and skip across his picture lenses. Fluid is dripping everywhere, splashing on the screens and making them smear. Tiafa has flounced off, readying herself for what she supposes will be a painful and semi-successful stint in the amniotic sphere. Dragon has ghosted away too, retreating, for now, to wherever he goes when the darkness is on him. It is Hovik who makes the first breakthrough. She is leaning over a sensor column, turning a dial slowly, her face underlit by rapidly strobing lights.
"My lord," she says.
Vorks walks over to her. She is using ancient equipment. Everything on the bridge is ancient. Without its incorporated biological growths and deep-sunk organic fusions, it would have given up long ago. The Death Guard no longer tend machinery. They have forgotten how. But they understand cells and respiration and circulation, and so much of what they use employs these methods.
"I have a partial match,"
she reports, gesturing towards the cracked lens cover. Vorks takes a look. He sees overlaid stellar schematics, lines of soft phosphor traced over a lattice of hand-drawn sigils. He sees correspondences, albeit only partially.
"We have come a long way," he murmurs.
"I cannot read these runes,"
Hovik says, isolating calligraphic script on the facsimile of parchment. Vork struggles to do so. Once he would have been able to read Gothic as easily as any other language, but two things have changed since his early career. He has grown older, and his mind is less rapid, and Gothic itself has evolved. It is now a language of internal contradictions and overlapping meanings, a palimpsest that never quite lets the old layers get wiped clean. It is uglier now, filled with more ornament than it ever used to have. But some words are technical and alter little.
"Segmentum obscurus," he reads. "Sector, subsector. I cannot make that out. Gods of regeneration, we are a long way out."
Hovik looks at him, concerned.
"Imperial space, sure enough. But I hear nothing. No astropathic bursts in the psi-scoop. No warp wakes. It is all empty."
Vorks looks harder. Hovik is right. The sensor readings are too few. It is as if some hand has scraped the universe clean, pulling the glimmers of life, always tenuous, from its dark surface.
"I sense shock," says Vorks. "Trauma response."
He turns to her.
"The despoiler has wounded reality, Hovik."
He laughs, a coarse, throttled snort through his congested airways.
"Perhaps Dragon is right. Perhaps Abaddon was the real thing."
The illusion passes over her head. Hovik, like all the unchanged, cares or understands little of the politics of the eye. She knows nothing of the furious warfare carried out over centuries within its tormented heart, or of the theological differences between its protagonists. She does not comprehend that a single plague marine might have to balance many competing loyalties towards his warband, his legion, his primarch, the despoiler's dominions, his own oaths made millennia ago, his desires. She has enough cares of her own, the ship, the many demands of the crew. Survival.
"I see nothing to aim for,"
she says, used to Vorks's cryptic musings and focused on the task at hand. He cycles the range a little further out, feeling like a fisherman throwing a net over a dry wasteland. Then Drez Ul, half buried amid old and creaking auger platforms, gets something.
"Long range void sounding,"
he announces, working furiously.
Distress, I think, hard to pick out.
Forks is moving.
Lock it down, he orders. How far?
On the edge of our scopes,
says Drez Uil.
And we are heading away from it.
Full turn,
says Vorks, and the command is relayed by Hovik to the navigation pits. Slave crew jump to action, hauling levers, stamping trajectory scrolls, and sending them trundling down vacuum tubes. Stars wheel across the real viewers as Solace awkwardly comes about.
Reel it in.
Philemon enters, cradling a little lord and some rolls of parchment. He draws alongside Vorks and watches the picture lenses scroll.
Found something?
He asks.
I do not know yet,
says Vorks, greeting him with a nod.
A lure to chase, at least. Your demon is restored.
Philemon hands the little lord to Vorks, who glances at it, grunts, and turns back to the auger. The creature blows an outraged raspberry and hops up into the rafters, where it sits, sulking.
I looked into the numerology,
says Philemon.
Hmm? We hold fate in our hands,
says the tallyman.
For the first time since the Hive came among us, there are real choices here, Siege Master. You understand me?
Vorks half listens. He is watching the phosphor blip as it travels over the lens.
It has never been thus in living memory,
Philemon goes on.
We have been permitted to raid here and there, to bleed the corpse a little, a slice or two of flesh. Now the door is opened. This brings danger. You will see it soon. We will all need to learn.
Vorks is looking at the signal of the ship. Some details are emerging. It is Imperial, and it is running. It looks small.
Where is the Lord Primarch? He asks.
I do not know. We have been displaced in both time and location.
We have our orders.
So you keep saying.
Vorks turns to face the tallyman.
Somethings endure. I will find him again, fight at his side, just as I promised we would.
Philemon's face is exposed. His concern is obvious. His sore, thick lip twitches.
You have the care of this warband, Lord, he says. Do not neglect it.
Aquatic hunters, says Vorks.
Quite.
We need data.
I understand.
Vorks sighs.
I will give this to Dragan. I will lend him Garstag and the Cardane. They can take what they want from it, as long as I have the information.
Go yourself.
In another age, Vorks might have raised an eyebrow. He no longer has eyebrows. He barely has a forehead.
You need to kill,
Philemon says.
You need to give them trophies.
I am not some petty warlord.
Yes, you are.
Philemon smiles sadly.
We all are, for now. Play the part a little longer, and we may yet survive to see a restoration of what was promised.
Vorks thinks on this. As he does so, the bridge becomes more animated around him. Other stations pick up the scent, and servitors flex their bound fingers and gape into oculus enhancers. Solace itself trembles, as if it smells something in the void and yearns to wrap its mandibles around fresh meat.
I do not need to prove myself, Vorks says.
All the time,
Philemon replies,
none of us escapes.
Vorks emits a sour chuckle. He likes Philemon, and he likes the tallyman's fatalism. All the breed share this trait. They, by vocation, peer into the darkest corners of the universe's foundations, the matterless structure on which all else is built, and it makes them dour.
Very well, Vorks says. Bring me exact.
I shall scrape the rust off it with the unbeliever's flesh.
His Imperial Majesty's service ship ER-587D runs hard. The engines are dangerously hot. This is not a warp-capable vessel, and it does not have the heavy shielding units over its engineering core that a bigger ship would carry. It does not have the navigators, and it does not have much in the way of weaponry. It has a complement of 52 armed guardians taken from Najan's standing local defense forces, all of whom are now on high alert. It has 6 pulse guns set 4, and an old las cannon lodged under the main cockpit overhang, which Captain Kovasha has never had a great deal of faith in, and has only had cause to use twice in over 10 years. A service ship is not designed to fight. It is not even designed to be on its own. For the last few decades, ER-587D has never been out of the shadow of protective escorts. Its management protocols are all built around short journeys between colony worlds, its holds stuffed with synth grains and bulk carb loads. Kovasha can't remember when he didn't have a destroyer or a monitor within a few hours' hail distance. His training has always emphasized that if in peril, run to the shadow of your protectors. But there are no protectors left. He is becoming light-headed as he sits on his crude command throne. His palms are wet. He feels as if the universe has folded in on itself, the old certainties gone, and no new ones ready to take their place. There is a terrible rumour spread over the intership Voxnet while it still existed that the Astronomicon beacon is gone and that the navigators have been driven mad by its loss and the entire sector fleet is adrift and burning. Now the net is down. No signals from Najan have been received for 4 days. This feeds other rumours, that Terra itself has been consumed by fire, that monsters are now bursting from the hearts of men, that the chapters of the Adeptus Astartes have withdrawn their protection from the Imperium, and that planets are being devoured one by one. Kovasha would not normally believe rumours like that. He is that rarest thing in the Imperium, a calm and rational man, and yet now his all-consuming fear is making him jumpy.
"How far?"
he asks his sensorium mistress. Isla turns to face him from down in the auger trench, looking as clammy as he feels. "Nothing yet, but, oh, throne, I have something on the long-range scanners now." Kovasha feels his stomach lurch. "Show me." His throne-mounted array of lenses switches to near-field, rotated for main yaw correction. He struggles to focus as the view pans and then drunkenly zooms, but finally something comes into focus, several hundred kilometers off, but closing very fast. He swallows.
"What is that?"
he croaks. No answers come. No one on the bridge has seen anything like it, except perhaps in their nightmares.
"It is on an intercept course," Isla says weakly. "We cannot go any faster."
Kovasha does not know where the destroyers are. There was something a week ago, only half picked up, about emergency protocols being enacted and all naval assets going to Crimson Station. But of course, that meant nothing to him. And in any case, they were due to dock with the mass conveyor Davanger 13 by the scheduled switch time, and so could not pay much attention to garbled intercepts. Only the conveyor wasn't there, and the comm fell into silence. And it stayed silent. They have been running for Najan ever since, perfectly aware that, whatever has happened, it is wholly unprecedented and very serious. He finds that his hand is shaking and clenches it against the armrest of his throne.
"Evasive manoeuvres," he says.
Isla stares at him. The navigation captain, Splayed, stares at him. They are in a volume of empty space. They have standard subplasma drives. They do not know what he means by evasive manoeuvres. But Kovasha doesn't say any more. He feels something hot and wet in his lap and looks down. His nose is bleeding. The drops form a dark web on his fatigues. He wipes the blood away, but it won't stop coming. Then he can hear what sounds like buzzing over the ship's voxcasters and wraps the transmitter attached to the throne. Isla looks suddenly unwell. She bends over in her seat, clutching her stomach. Kovasha struggles to concentrate.
How close?
He asks. Isla does not answer. Splade reaches over to her station and stares at the data.
Holy saints, it's right on us,
he says. Then he suddenly belches and vomits over Isla's tactical column, gripping it until his knuckles go white. Automatic proximity klaxons start up, whirling and wailing. The bridge lumens flicker and die, plunging them all into perfect dark.
Emergency power!
Shrieks Kovasha, getting to his feet and reaching for his sidearm. Blood is running freely over his chin now, and he feels faint. Dull red lumens glow into life, doing the bare minimum to banish the shadows. He sees silhouettes of his crew stumbling around, some bleeding like he is, others gripping themselves in agony that has come from nowhere. The buzzing is getting worse. It makes it hard to think. He staggers across the main dais. He can hear thumps from somewhere up above, and then a big crash. The ship reels, spinning around as if it has been punched by a giant hand. He hears metal screaming against metal, then a series of explosions. He curses as he realizes that his power pack is empty. He has been meaning to check it properly for the long days of the race home, but something more important has always come up. He lurches back to the throne, to the compartments built into the arms with all the many essential things he needs to store and use. As he drops to his knees, he hears the crashes getting closer, huge impacts, one after the other, like horrific drumbeats. The klaxons wail, and the buzzing starts to hurt his ears. He gets to the compartment, reaches for the security catch, fumbles it. He has blood on his gloves, and his chest is now sticky with it. The buzzing becomes maddening, and he swats at imaginary flies. Isla is still vomiting. The liquid has turned bloody and black. Men are screaming, women are screaming, and the deck is vibrating underfoot to a steady and increasing slam rhythm. Kovasha can hardly see what he's doing, but he manages to pull the hatch open and get a fresh power pack out. Trembling, he slots the replacement into the sidearm and depresses the inlet catch. Then he's turning, swinging around to face the bridge, holding the lasgun two-handed and trying to find something to aim at. The darkness is as thick as bilge, a jumble of blurred outlines against a dull red haze. The buzzing drowns out even the screams now, though he still can't see any damn flies. His skin crawls. His bleeding gets worse. Splade is hurling up something stringy. Then the doors blow apart. Bodies of guardians fly through the ragged gap, their limbs flopping. Kovasha aims his lasgun and fires. Three lines of searing heat that light up tortured shapes he cannot identify. For a moment, he thinks he is shot into a mess of writhing snakes spilling through the jagged breach to slap and slither across the deck. But then giants stride into the open, and he sees that the snakes are coils of flesh erupting from thick plates of armor. The giants are monsters of shadow. Their stink is phenomenal, clogging the air. It makes him instantly gag, and he feels saliva pool in his cheeks even as he scrabbles away. They do not hurry. Pale green points of light shine from grotesque helms. Miasma clouds them, swirling about their every movement. Kovasha fires again, then again, his finger glued to the trigger in his panic. He cannot see how many there are. Five? Six? They are not saying anything. He can hear only breathing, like a caged animal's, throaty and phlegmy. His crew are being killed, steadily and methodically, and he cannot do anything. He swivels round, his back against the command throne, and fires some more. Every lasbeam lights up more horror, claws ripping through skin, bones breaking under cloven treads. Then, one of the monsters comes for him, stalking with deliberation, absorbing the las fire as if it were a patter of raindrops. Kovasha sees a fractured helm and twin lenses that shine with a sick, pale light. He sees a huge scythe sweep through the clouds of flies and dust, ludicrously big, with a blunt blade that drips with an oily residue. The monster isn't even really using it. It's holding the weapon one-handed and killing with its other fist, barely reaching out. Kovasha, in his mindless terror, notices odd details. He notices that the monster has numbers etched on its armor, hundreds of them, alongside other little signs and symbols he does not recognize. He notices that there is a larger image on the hemisphere of its shoulder guard, a finger held up against a closed mouth. He notices, even in the dark, that the color of the plate is indeterminate, a mottled pattern of grays, blacks, greens, and ivories, like lichen on old rock, overlapping and overlaid in a parody of sedimentation. Then he is looking right into the monster's eyes. He can smell its sulphurous aura, hear its claggy breaths within the cavern of its chest. He wants to scream out, but his throat has seized up. He cannot fire his weapon. He cannot move. The monster leans over him.
"You are fortunate," it says, in
slurring Gothic that sounds like something from the dawn of time. The accent is heavy, alien, palpably ancient, distorted by a vox mask and the tubes and whatever else lurks under that nightmarish faceplate. Kovasha can barely process that. Fortunate? Is that a sick joke? The monster looms closer, and the stench nearly makes Kovasha lose consciousness.
"You will teach us," the monster says. "That is what preserves you. Consider it a trade."
Kovasha understands none of that. This has become unreal, like a drug-induced dream, something that cannot possibly be happening.
"Where?"
he blurts, spitting up more blood. The monster waits patiently.
"You are trying to speak. Try again." "Where?"
says Kovasha. The monster gives him time.
"Where are you from?"
That seems to give it pause. It rests on the scythe, and a gurgling chuckle slips from its helm.
"Where are we from?"
It draws in a long, wheezing breath. Kovasha thinks it is amused, though he has no idea why.
"Not the first time I've been asked," it says. "And it is a story. But then again, we have plenty of time. So listen."